Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Opel. Get behind the wheel of your new Opel at the Opel Open Road event now on at your Opel dealer. Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
For over 7 years, my next guest was subjected to horrific sexual abuse and rape at the hands of her father. Charlene Masterson was just 18 years old when she started receiving anonymous text messages blackmailing her, which later transpired to have been sent by her father, David Masterson. The messages began demanding that she do sexual things with men while threatening to send information to her father's work. When she told her father about what was happening, Masterson said she would have to do these things because his job was at risk. Last week, David Masterson was sentenced to 17 years in jail for the crimes, and Charlene decided to waive her right to anonymity, and she joins me in studio this morning. Good morning to you, Charlene.
Good morning, Claire. How are you? Thanks
for joining us. Very well. How have you been? Because it's been a week now since you made this decision to go public. You've been congratulated and received plaudits from right across the spectrum, even as far as Taoiseach Micheál Martin commending you for what you've done. But how have you been?
Tired, exhausted. Like, no sleep last night, but on general, I've been sleeping fine. But I think it's just the magnitude of everything has really set in. I'm kind of very nonchalant about the whole thing. You know, it's fine. You know, I'm still here and it's fine. I've been really overwhelmed and kind of taken aback by the level of support from everybody. I think I was kind of prepping myself for maybe some negative comments or, you know, like the usual kind of keyboard warriors and stuff online, but it has actually been all positive, which has been amazing.
It struck me as well in hearing you speak after the case that you were very positive about your future and, you know, you were keen to stress, I am still alive, I'm still here. Has it settled with you, do you think, what you've been through?
Yeah, I mean, I know I've spoken about it with a lot of people since last week, but over the last couple of months, you know, being in and out of court and stuff, I've been living with this now for 14 years. So I did 7.5 years of abuse and living in that horrific circumstance, and then 7 years since it stopped. So I've kind of had that time to process it. I'm now looking at family and friends that are learning about it, or I know a lot of my friends would have had an idea, but kind of they know the magnitude of it now that it's been in the press, or I've been talking about it a little bit more. So I'm now watching the hurt and kind of upset that, you know, it's caused them, and, you know, them trying to process it now. So I'm seeing the magnitude kind of through them. I kind of have kind of processed it, and, you know, I'm out the other side now. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this whole waiving anonymity is a different journey now, and kind of the work that I want to do as a result of what I've been through is kind of the next step.
But you've no regrets?
No, not one.
What did it mean to you for the Taoiseach to come out and say and commend your eloquence and your bravery? And as far as he's concerned, he feels that what you have done will help other people.
I was gobsmacked. My friends were so excited because I'm not on Twitter, so I didn't see any of this. And one of my friends messaged me and he said, oh my God, my friend's trending on Twitter. And I was like, what are you talking about? So that really just, I just couldn't believe it. I had hoped my kind of goal from day one of, you know, deciding to waive my anonymity was to help people. It was going to serve a purpose. And I hope that the Taoiseach recognising it is just step one of the journey and that it is going to go above and beyond, hopefully.
Another thing that you said that struck me was that the reality of the abuse that you suffered at the hands of your father, that it only really struck you as you were writing your victim impact statement. I mean, was that very recent that you sat down to write that?
Yeah, I only wrote that maybe, did I start writing that after the 25th of January, which is when my father pleaded guilty in court. So I knew I needed an impact statement then for standing up in court in April. And it was only then, you know, you're kind of going through how you felt. And it was only writing that that I realised that the kind of control and the grooming, for want of a better word, started probably back in my early teens. Like, Dad would know things that there's no way in hell he would know unless he was physically there at the time. So, I mean, I did realize after he left the family home in 2014 that he had been tracking my mobile phone. I'm like 99% sure that dated back to my early teens, because he would just know things. And if I ever questioned it, it was a, you know, oh, fathers know everything. Mm-hmm. And there was always that kind of a line or kind of premise with him.
The overt abuse didn't start, though, until you were 18. Is that right?
Yeah, within a month of me turning 18.
I'm going to ask you a bit about that now, and tell me about it in as much as you're comfortable. And I don't expect you to go any further than that. So you feel now, looking back, that he was being controlling, looking at your every move for a couple of years before you turned 18.
Yeah.
But then it took a different turn. So you started getting these messages from this anonymous number. And they were threatening you, were they?
Yeah, it was very much, I know what you've done. Now, in hindsight, and we all know hindsight's a fantastic thing. In hindsight, I hadn't done anything. I was a very well-behaved teenager. I didn't hang around street corners. I didn't get into trouble. I had so many after-school activities. I didn't have time to be doing anything untoward. So I probably should have known, but also I wasn't used to getting in trouble. So if someone said I'd done something wrong, it was obviously panic. But in normal circumstances, you'd go to your father and he'd be like, look, it's fine. You didn't do anything. That unfortunately wasn't the response that I got. It was a very cool, collected response. You know, well, you know, you just have to do it. Very, you know, matter of fact. That's just the way it is.
And when he was saying you have to do it, this was engage in sexual activity in order for the threats not to be carried out.
Yeah.
Did you tell your friends about these messages?
No. I remember when I asked the person, who we later found out was my father, when I asked them like where they got my number from, they named one of my friends. So I just went and asked that friend. I was like, did you give my number to somebody? And it wasn't the case. He had no idea what I was talking about. But I just, you know, I would never have guessed that it was my dad. That's just, you know, it wouldn't enter anybody's head that would be your father.
So then in order to deal with this, he collaborated with you to engage with this person who you later discovered was him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's basically the whole story. It's, you know, it was, you have to do this, you have to do that. And it was always when he was there. So he would be in the house and he portrayed that as, you know, you're safe because I'm here. I won't let anything happen. But really, it was him doing
the abuse.
The abuse.
It wasn't just him.
No, there was another person a couple of times, the same person, which I think from what I can gather, I haven't got the full kind of lowdown on the case or summary on the case yet. But from what I can gather, there was one person that knew that I was his daughter. So they weren't in their own knowledge taking part in that too.
Mm-hmm. And how long before you figured this out that it was him? Because the abuse, we should explain to people who don't know, the abuse was happening, but you weren't able to see the person who was carrying out the abuse.
Yeah.
So you were oblivious for a time. You felt that he was protecting you from these threats that were coming.
Yeah.
And then eventually you figured out what was going on.
Yeah. So my grandmother had this kind of laptop thing and my dad was supposed to be installing new software. And one day when he was in work, I was like, I'll be really helpful and I'll, you know, install the software. And I went to pull the disc and there was these two DVDs with kind of squiggly lines on. And I was like, I'll just wonder what that is. And I put it in and it was recordings of two of the incidents, actually the first two, which I knew because that was part of kind of the bargaining chip was that they would be recorded to confirm that it had been done or something. I can't remember the details, but that it was of those two recordings.
Mm-hmm. Can you remember how you felt in that moment?
I remember slamming the laptop shut and kind of just putting it all back because I just didn't know what to do next. I mean, in that situation, you would turn to your father if you'd found something like that, but it was him, so I didn't have anywhere to turn to.
Sometimes when we feel betrayed, we try and justify it, don't we? We say he has this recording for another reason.
Yeah.
Did you do that?
I probably did. I don't think it was long. I can't remember now how long it was before I kind of called it out. It could have been the exact same day. I don't know. But I was getting messages and had said, you know, I know it's you, to the text messages. He was up in bed having a lie down, and that kind of a row broke out in the house between us, because he kind of did the how could you think that was me, but at the same time I never got another text message after that. So to me it kind of, you know, common sense prevails here.
But he never admitted it either?
No, never.
So what happened after that, after the row and you finding that DVD? Where did everything go from there, Charlene?
I don't know when it, I can't pinpoint when it spiraled into just open abuse from him, but it literally just, like, sexual harassment and, like, say, for example, if I didn't kiss him goodnight, there was hell to pay the next day. Or if I went out with my friends. So I started kind of retracting from everything then. I lost my hobby. I lost, I gave up my part-time job. I literally had college at home.
When you say hell to pay, what does that mean?
Could mean anything from rape to violence, or, and you just didn't know. And if I did something one day and did the exact same thing the next day, it could be wrong the next day. So he was just never happy, really.
Physically violent as well.
Yeah.
So how long after you discovered the DVD did this go on for then?
4 years.
And it was your friend who was training to be a social worker?
Yeah.
Who suspected there was something wrong?
Yeah. She in the So he left in the June of 2014. So in the March of 2014, we were at a weekend away in Killarney. And he hadn't wanted, he told me not to go. But I was like, I'm 25, I'm going to go. And he spent the entire weekend messaging me and threatening me, and he was going to come down and get me, and he was sending me like details of all these people he wanted me to meet, and you know, the signal in the hotel wasn't great, so I wasn't getting the messages instantly, which meant I wasn't replying instantly, so that wasn't good. And she just outright asked me the day we were going home, is your dad abusing you? And I just, no. And she was like, you're not defending him like someone whose father has just been wrongly accused.
Mm-hmm. So she saw the level of texting that was going on.
Yeah.
All the messages that you were getting. And she must have seen the impact it was having on you as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was, even to go on that weekend was big, because I had stopped going on nights out and everything. It just wasn't worth going out. It wasn't worth the aggro when I came home. But she had seen it and then kept on my case until June of that year.
Just before we follow that track, you said something there about him sending you messages about people he wanted you to meet.
Yeah.
Was he still forcing you to have sex with other people?
Yeah.
After you discovered the DVDs?
Yeah.
So everything was out in the open now.
Yeah.
And he'd broken you to the point that this could carry on.
Yeah.
For the full 7 years.
And he thought it was completely normal. I remember leaving, you know, like a Woman's Own or one of those kind of trashy chat magazines, and there was a story in it, I'll never forget it, there's a story in it about a father and daughter who were having a relationship, and I kind of left it open in a, maybe this will kind of trigger something in him that will tell him this is not normal, it's not right. And he just laughed it off, and he said, do you think that's going to make me think it's not normal? So he, in his head, he thought this was completely normal, and it's not. So there was just never ending. He just...
You were afraid of him, weren't you?
Petrified. But even as a kid, like, he never put his hand on me as a child. But there was always that fear. He was a big man. And I always had that fear. But never physically harmed me until I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I know a lot of people can go, oh, you know, she was 18, she should have known better, blah, blah, blah. But until you're in that situation, gripped with fear, it's, you can't give an opinion on it. You know, it's easier said than done to tell someone.
Walk in my shoes before you open your mouth, isn't that it?
100%, yeah.
To go back to your friend, the angel who was training to be
Absolutely.
A social worker, and who saw what she knew was happening. I mean, she had a fair idea, I'd say, that trip to Killarney.
Yeah.
You didn't react in the way perhaps that she had hoped you'd react,
yeah,
but she kept pushing.
Yeah, and he knew that she knew, because obviously he had my phone tracked, so he was seeing all our correspondence anyway between myself and my friend. And he took a dislike to her, and then it was, well, you won't be seeing her again. Or, and she was at the time, I was in a dance group and she was a teacher in that dance group. And so, you know, there was the threat, well, you won't be going back there again. And no, I kept pushing, and I did thankfully stay there until June of that year. But there was always, you know, well, you won't be seeing her again, because he knew that she knew what he was and who he was.
Mm-hmm. And what made you then decide, I am going to do something about this now?
I don't think I had decided, but that weekend, so my friend that eventually made me talk out, she was moving to a different country like 2 weeks later. And I think in her head, she was like, I'm not moving until I know she's safe. And it was, we had done a show that weekend, and it had kind of reached a point that weekend that, you know, he didn't care who was around. And I had another friend staying with me that weekend, and she was in bed in my room, which is above the sitting room. And he had me up against the wall by my throat, and she was upstairs. So he had reached that point of, I don't care who hears me. Or
he must have felt then he had complete control and he could do what he wanted.
Yeah.
So you got to the point where you said, enough is enough.
Yeah. My friend texted me and she said, you know, this was after the shows and kind of things had reached a peak. And she said, if you need to come over to me. And I was like, no, I can't. She said, well, you come over or I'm coming over to you. So I was like, oh, Jesus, no, I can't have that. So I went over and we sat in her back garden for possibly 6 hours talking absolute nonsense. And it was 11:30 at night. And I said, right, I need to go home now. And because I knew my dad was going to be home maybe 12:30, he was on a late shift. And she was like, well, you're not leaving until you tell me what you need to tell me. And I said, I don't need to tell you anything. She says, okay, I'll just ask you some questions. And she literally just asked the question and confirmed it. And then the next, she didn't want me going home that evening, but I was like, no, I have to go home.
Did she ask you the same question that she'd asked you in the March?
Yeah.
Which was, is your father abusing you?
Yeah.
She asked you again in June, and this time you said?
Yes. And like, I didn't cry. And I know the next day, like when my mum found out and it was kind of, it came out the next day, I didn't cry. Everyone else was crying, but I just had this, it was probably a sense of relief that it was over. You know, I wouldn't see him again. And well, until court this year. But it was, yeah, I just, the emotion just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. How did he react? Did he leave the house immediately?
Yeah, I mean, my mum found out, she rang him and he says, oh, you know, I'll get help. And, you know, and she's like, just get out. Don't even. And he I think he was gone in 30 minutes. Again, he packed up his stuff. But there was, you know, I think he thought there was some chance of reconciliation. I don't know. I don't know what he thought, but he left straight away.
Did he ever get in touch with you after that?
No.
So you've had no contact with him since that day?
I saw him about a year and a half later at his mother's funeral. I'm quite stubborn and I said, I'm going to that funeral. She was my grandmother, so I'm going. That would have been the first time that I saw him and the last time until April of this year.
What has it been like seeing him in the courtroom?
So I've seen him now on 3 occasions as we had 3 separate court dates. And I kind of had, and I know one of the ladies from the Rape Crisis Centre who have been just incredible. They had kind of, we were chatting before the first day and she'd said, you know, what might throw you? What can we do to kind of combat anything that might throw you before you go in or when you go in? So I, in my head, I had said, okay, maybe seeing him for the first time, I had thought maybe this might have had kind of a physical impact on him, that he might be a frailer man, or because he's quite a big man. He was like 20 stone. I kind of thought, you know, it'll have impacted his weight and he'll be older and, you know, it will have physically impacted him. And so there's a little glass panel in the door. So I was able to see him before physically going in and he hadn't changed at all. It had had zero impact on him. So that actually threw me more so.
Did he make eye contact with you?
Yeah, a number of times. And it was the last time on the first day, the last time he looked at me was the last time because I just stared him down. And then the second day I went in, I felt nothing. Which was surprising for me, but I'm really thankful for it. Mm-hmm. I felt absolutely nothing.
How did you feel about the sentencing, the length of the sentence?
Yeah, I mean, everyone's asking, but I didn't really. I have this thing where I don't preempt things because then if it doesn't happen, I'm not devastated or I'm not really disappointed. And if it does happen, great, happy days. So I know I'd kind of been looking at like historical cases in this area and stuff, and kind of 15 years is normally where it starts and then, you know, it comes down mitigating circumstances and stuff.
And he got 17.
And he got 7. It started at 24. And then it was due to mitigating circumstances, the mitigation being he admitted it and he pleaded guilty and he said everything I said was truthful. It got lessened to 18 with the last year suspended. That's just, it's unheard of, mm-hmm. which is shocking, to be honest, because all cases of this nature are horrific. I'm really, really thankful. But, you know, as the system, he won't serve all those years.
But it's another indication to you the seriousness of what you've been through.
Absolutely. Know? It was very much, and the judge was very kind and very complimentary to me throughout the whole court proceeding. And it is something I will never, ever forget. But I think it does send a message, you know, thankfully, the judge didn't take this lightly and he really did take it seriously and recognise the magnitude of it.
You've been having counselling and you've been having help throughout all of this.
Yeah. Not so much counselling. I did try like 8 different counsellors. And it wasn't until I spoke to someone else that has been through something similar. I always thought I was weird because everyone was like, you know, you have to go to counselling. And I just didn't feel like it worked. And it wasn't until I spoke to someone else and they were like, yeah, no, I didn't do the counselling thing either. For me, I think talking about it and helping others is going to be my counselling. It's going to be my help. It's something that I definitely want to do. There's a lot I want to change or add to our system and to our country in relation to this type of crime and help for survivors.
Mm-hmm.
Especially.
And the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre has been helping you through.
Oh my God, yes.
This part of
amazing.
It.
Amazing. The two ladies that I've been working with are amazing. They were completely invaluable, especially in court. But even afterwards, they're just unbelievable. Mm-hmm.
Because the court experience, that's an alien one. And a
Absolutely.
Very difficult one because you're dealing with the legal process, but also the emotion and the impact around having him there, having to see him. You haven't seen him in so long. All of these things must be very, very challenging to deal with.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you can mentally prepare yourself all you want, but it's a different story when you're in there. You know, I had kind of been preparing myself that maybe I wouldn't deliver my impact statement myself. But once I got in there and kind of found my feet, I was like, no, actually, I'll regret if I walk out of here and let someone else read it. I'll regret it. So I definitely, that was one thing I definitely wanted to do.
When we started this interview, you referred to David Masterson as dad. Do you still see him as dad?
No. No, I haven't had a dad since I was 18. The minute he put his hand on me, it's really sad. Like I've watched friends of mine lose their fathers that they really, really loved. And, you know, I've been there when they grieved and etc. I'll probably never have that. It's something, I mean, I'm an only child. I don't have siblings to fall back on. We have a really small family. There isn't a massive family unit. So to not have a father, like I'm not married. If I ever do get married, there's no one to walk me down the aisle. You know, it's that kind of thing. And like, Jesus, when I was a kid, I used to dream that I'd be married and, you know, father, daughter, dance and all these really special things. But I won't have that. I'll never have that. And I think I'm okay with that now. Because I'd rather not have one than have one that done what he did. So, yeah, I think it's just easier if I call him dad.
So what are you going to do now? What are your plans now that you've been through all of this? Or can you see beyond where you are right now?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing some online courses and stuff around like domestic violence and like domestic violence awareness courses and stuff. And I've noticed that there isn't a lot that relate to Irish law. And that's something I definitely want to change, something that should be freely kind of available here. And I know like the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre and all, they offer like training courses. But I always question whether if my friend had not been training to be a social worker, would I still be in that situation? Or actually, I probably wouldn't still be here, if I'm honest. I'd love to. And I always use the stroke campaign that was going on years ago where they had the fast and had that. I would love to develop something like that. Just little pinpoint, little triggers that people could maybe just visually see in people or observe in people that might indicate that something isn't
right. That they're in trouble.
And I just feel that there's a massive stigma still in this country around sexual violence and rape and sexual assault, and it shouldn't be here. So I want to get out of the career that I'm in and focus on changing things. And I know, like, say, for example, writing my impact statement, there's no guidance on that really in the country. And there shouldn't be, you know, a set template, because it is supposed to be from your own thoughts and your feelings. But some guidance should be available or something, because that's something that really is lacking.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely something to help friends and family of survivors also, because I know they carry a lot of guilt, and they shouldn't. I mean, the only guilt should be with the offender.
Mm. And how's your mother?
She's good. She's good.
I know you've paid tribute to the support that she gave
you. She's amazing. She's one of the most hardworking women I've ever met in my life. And I know she carries guilt with her. But I mean, as I've said to her before, if she'd have been at home for 23 hours of the day, he'd have got me in the last hour. That's what they do. They're so calculated. And, you know, I mean, he was following me into my job, my part-time job. I wasn't safe anywhere. So, you know what I mean? My mom is just, she's incredible.
Mm-hmm.
She's absolutely incredible.
Well, Charlene, you've done the state some service, and you've done people some service who will have listened to this and heard your previous words as well after the court case, and will take heart and take strength from what you've done. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And I wish you well.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And if you've been affected by anything you've just heard and need to talk to someone, help is available from the Dublin Rape Crisis Centre, and their phone line is open now, 1-800-77-8888. That's 1-800-77-8888. Or you can check out rte.ie/helplines. We're going to speak to the CEO of the HSE, Paul Reid, after this break.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.